Hadi bakalım. Hadi bakalım. Hadi bakalım.
Welcome, everybody. We're starting out today with a big announcement. We are being bought by the Daily Wire. Yes, that's right. Welcome to the Daily Wire version of Human Reaction. Today, we're talking about why we need to bomb Israel immediately. No, bomb Iran for Israel. Man, we're going to get fired before we even start. Dude.
This is not going to be a long-lived relationship. I can already tell. Already going off script.
Yeah, man. Whoops. I need a teleprompter. Give me some of that equipment there, Ben. Let's go.
Some budget would be great. Yeah, so, if you got it lying around. I don't know. Here you're in financial hardship. Maybe we can help. I don't know.
Well, nothing will bring together their financial fundamentals than bringing on Human Reaction Podcast. I mean, we make tens of dollars a week now. So
that's right. Hey. Rolling in it. Just rolling in it. But, at least we're keeping ourselves out of jail. You know, that's probably about all we can say is a win for the show at this point. But, hey, we're having a lot of fun while we're doing it, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're clipping along. So we got some great stories today. We're going to be talking about Luigi Mangione. See how good I pronounced that time? I've been practicing.
That was great.
You can tell.
That was great.
Yeah. The DOJ has announced that they're going to be pursuing the federal death penalty for him. A very interesting development there. And Congress had an assassination hearing on the JFK assassination. And it is fascinating. I mean, it's just definitely a lot of interesting tidbits got brought up. We're going to dive into that, as well as some developments around the assassination that we'll be getting into as well. So that's what we're talking about today.
Let's kick it off. So what is going on with Luigi Mangione?
MSNBC had a pretty good start to it, so I'll play that and we can get that going.
The Justice Department has just said Attorney General Pam Bondi has directed prosecutors to seek the death penalty against Luigi Mangione. He's the man charged with killing United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson on a New York City street back in December. With us now, MSNBC legal analyst Danny Savalas. Danny, good morning. So what is exactly the Justice Department saying and what are they basing it on?
Well, one of the crimes Mangione is charged with is murder with a firearm, which is a capital offense under federal law. So the death penalty is a possibility. But in federal death penalty cases, it is a two-stage process. The jury not only decides guilt, but then they are the ones who ultimately decide whether the defendant lives or is put to death. It is not the judge that hands out the sentence. That's why death penalty juries have to be qualified, and it's a much more onerous process to seat a capital jury, because you have to ask them questions, difficult questions, like if the death penalty is on the table, can you actually sentence someone to death? So this is a very big decision by the federal government, maybe not a surprising one, but given how rarely over the years the federal government has sought the death penalty, it is certainly a significant decision by Pam Bondi.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, Danny. I mean, what cases have there been where the federal government has been requesting the death penalty? And I'm thinking, you know, more than one person having been killed. It is unusual.
I believe that the last most recent death penalty execution in the federal system was carried out in 2021, and that was related to a crime that was committed, just to give you some context, in 1996. So that's how long death penalty cases can take. And at the federal level, it's interesting because, you know, states like New York may not have the death penalty, but technically every state has, and I'm using air quotes, the death penalty, because they could be charged with a federal crime in that state and put to death, even if the state itself does not have the death penalty, as is the case with New York.
All right. Yeah.
So they're going for the big one, huh? What do you make of that, David?
Well, I am no fan of the death penalty, if anything, because my skepticism of the ability of the government to secure good convictions, especially when you look at the DNA evidence. Death penalties have a history of being inaccurate. We put to death, unfortunately, many people before we had DNA evidence. I was later exonerated with DNA evidence. That said, you know, it's not overly surprising, both politically and otherwise. It's interesting here because some of the coverage definitely tilts to, well, this is the murderous Donald Trump campaign and he's a dictator and all that kind of stuff. Others, but they're not including things like these things, such as pursuing the death penalty, were speculated under the Biden administration. And the whole reason we're actually here in the first place with a federal prosecution rather than the state prosecution in the state of New York is because the Biden administration escalated it to a federal charge. So interesting moment when it comes to those things, like both sides kind of playing with it. So it's a start of, I think, a larger conversation on death penalty that I would love to have. But I don't think people are going to hear it specifically with this case because it's a targeted killing specifically for political motives.
Right. Well, and I'm with you. I don't agree with the death penalty generally, personally, but I would say it is a little bit of a different case, you know, given your hesitancy around the government not being able to secure a solid conviction. This one's very cut and dry. He did it. He admitted to it. It seems very clear that he is the perpetrator of this crime. So does that change the way that you think the public is looking at this?
Well, he did plead not guilty.
Fair.
So, I mean, but that said, the evidence was pretty substantial. I mean, included having a gun with a silencer on him, a fake ID, the cell phone data supportive of him being in the area, and a notebook with planning details. And that was all publicly actually demonstrated to the public in December 19th. So just to remind everybody, so he kills the guy December 4th, 5 days manhunt. He's caught in Pennsylvania, potentially trying to flee. I don't know why you wouldn't go to Canada. Maybe he's trying to go for Mexico. It's not really a southward direction. I don't know what his real plan. I mean, this is south of New York, but you think he'd get further. And then he pled not guilty. So he's since then been in detention in Brooklyn. And it's not an open and shut case. I don't know what their actual case is going to be at the end of the day to say that he's not guilty. There was some statements from his defense attorney, such as that saying that the state had a lack of evidence to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's the one who did it. And there was some stuff online. I mean, the internet sleuths on this immediately picked it up and immediately started saying, well, the eyebrows don't look quite right. I mean, they have similar eyebrows, but not the same. And the jacket is similar, but not quite the same. And what's going on here? So I don't know where this is going to go as far as that goes. But I do think the sociological, the larger picture of how our country and how our people deal with this is a very interesting question.
You're right. And yeah, just to be clear, I did completely misspeak. He did not admit to it. That never happened. But that's very interesting. So how are the public responding to this at this point? What are you seeing on that?
Well, we got this interesting poll here. 61% of polled Americans have a negative opinion of Luigi Mangione, even after being told his self-proclaimed motive was fighting corruption and greed. Non-whites, poor people, and leftists are more likely to have a positive opinion, but no demographic was majority positive. I think the numbers are pretty telling. Very positive at 10% is somewhat disturbing to me. I mean, I would suggest that there. I keep forgetting I got to blow this up total. Let's go there. There we go. So people can see it. So total positive at 18%, total negative at 61%. So that's, I mean, in public opinion polling, if you're bumping above 60 to 70%, that's a real majority. Keep in mind that there's probably a 5% to, 6% maybe error rate. We're only weighing a couple hundred people here. So that's not super accurate. But the total, as far as weighting in, that's what I mean, is like the total amount of people asked is 455. So that could have a little bit higher weight rate, but still 61% is a pretty good majority. Although I personally would be like, I would think it would be higher since he killed a guy,
the negative sentiment. You mean,
is that the soft bigotry of low expectations? I don't know.
Perhaps. Well, I mean, the media narrative around him at the time, and I suppose still to this day, but certainly right around the time of the event, was sort of heroic in nature. A lot of people were elevating this guy because he was sticking it to the man and all that. I mean, it didn't really seem like anybody cared that he had killed a person in this this moment. So, I mean, the media has obviously had some sway on that, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, obviously, the steel man of that is that there is a legitimate case to be made that he's a legitimate case. That's not quite right. That there's a case to just make this is his motive. His motive was this, right? And you're just being descriptive. And, people can take that and be like, well, I agree. Healthcare companies are bad and they deny service care. And I think they should be able to do that, not be able to do that. That's the political implications of that are pretty straightforward. The question is like, what is the means here? The means is to kill a guy in order to draw attention to, your preferred political solution. And are we so bad right now? Is our civics so bad that we're like, well, yeah, I mean, obviously that's I support him now. You know what I mean? You would think it would be much more nuanced than that. But it doesn't seem to be.
Well, no. And I suppose you are right. It is the soft bigotry of low expectations in a sense. I don't expect the public to have a lot of nuanced opinions right now on anything because we're so incredibly polarized just in general. So if this is something that the tribe is rallying around supporting of Luigi Mangione, then I could see a lot of people doing that just out of, the expectation that that's what the tribe does. That's what I'm going to do. The support for Luigi Mangione is not too far off from the approval rating of the Democratic Party at the moment. So maybe there's some crossover.
I think that makes sense. I mean, the left, I mean, we did a big video on this where it was Glenn Greenwald and Crystal Ball talking about it. No, not Crystal Ball. Joy. Who was it? Joy Reid.
Joy Gray.
I got her face in my head. I can't remember. I really like her. She's great.
Brianna
Joy Gray. That's right.
Yes.
And just their weird sexual fetishizing of him, and then circuitous way in which they justify it as they're declaring his motive, but not just simply describing his motive, but rather than going a step further than that and kind of justifying, well, a lot of people die from healthcare companies. They do stuff I don't like. So therefore, targeting this man who is a father and husband and a dude is somehow justifiable.
Yeah. What do you think about the strategic ramifications of the DOJ pursuing the death penalty in this case?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the extra step is step one, guilty or not guilty. Step two, what is the penalty? And I think that is really interesting that on the federal level, we have the jury decide the punishment on that level, right? I don't know. When you look at the justifiability numbers, they are lower, right? Versus I support him versus feel like the murder was justified. When you look at those numbers, they are, and this is specifically on how the might tell us about where a jury might go on this. So the total, very justifiable was at 6%. The total being of positive justifiable being at 12%. So it drops a little bit when you say, is murder okay? And it's going to be tried in New York. Where's that sentiment going to be there? I don't know. I think that's interesting, especially when you look at, here's some of the ideology. Total net positive amongst liberals is 16%, but the negative even amongst liberals is 74%. That's a substantially high thing for anything on public polling.
Right. Well, and that's positive to see, I think, just for the state of our humanity as a country. Do you think that, okay, so let's just assume he is found guilty and he is given the death penalty. Is this going to have blowback on the administration for going this route?
I don't think so. I mean, with those kind of support numbers, it's hard to imagine. I think it'll mean he'll be a martyr for the radical left that is kind of justifying this. But I don't see this as being something that will have mainstream effects, right? Because you got the far wings and they're really quite kind of isolated from their effect on the middle for the most part. So I don't see it having a political outcome of substance.
Interesting. What is the left saying on this stuff? Those that, have been very outspoken regarding the way the healthcare industry is leaving Americans behind, is killing people, et cetera. I mean, like the Glenn Greenwalds and the Brianna Joy Grays of the world? What are their opinions on this?
Yeah, so we got this this clip from a group. It's a mid-sized channel called what's it called? The Status Coup. And you notice the flag in the background here. He's got the corporations as the stars. So that tells you quite a bit about where we're going to be going with this. But I thought I'd let him speak for himself a little bit on how they're kind of processing this. I think it's insightful to look at their approach.
Murder charges. I am not surprised. I am not shocked. But I do want to point out, and we have been leading the coverage of this since it happened, not only on Mangione's case, but keeping in the news the predatory, murderous, for-profit health insurance industry that Status Quo has been covering as long as we've been alive, for 7 years. We've covered the Medicare. We've covered fraud from the predatory health insurance company. We covered the daily murder they're committing, United Health and all the rest of them. But I do want to point out, separate whatever you think of Luigi Mangione, whether you support what he did, and a lot of people do, whether you don't support what he specifically allegedly did, but understand the motivation, or whether you are against him. Put all that aside for a second.
Real quick, I just want to note that not a lot of people support what he did, right? I mean, we've seen the polling now. And I think it's insightful that his mental model is like a lot of people support what he did. So keep that in mind.
Boy, are they throwing the book at this guy, Mangione, for what he allegedly did, the death penalty for a targeted killing of one individual, allegedly, no criminal background. Seems like a different standard of justice, wouldn't you say? Let's go down the list, shall we? The last decade or so. Did one banker from JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, all the criminal banks, did one banker get a parking ticket, much less criminal charges for tanking the global economy, which killed people? People died as a result of foreclosures, being evicted, and all sorts of dominoes from the global financial crash that harmed millions of Americans. Anybody go to jail for that? Anybody even face a jury? Charged criminally? No. How about the Sackler family? You know,
let's stop there just for a second, and we'll go back to it because I think he's on a roll. Do you think we should have done what exactly? Like prosecuted with criminal charges bankers for the 2008 financial crisis?
I can't say that I think they should have gotten criminally charged, but they certainly should have been allowed to fail, and we should not have bailed them out.
Yeah. I would say that the Federal Reserve, which is the ultimate culprit here, not the everyday banking organization or just random bankers that you don't like because you've decided to interpret a macro cause for their micro, you know, motivation of greed as the cause of the crisis, it really leads you astray when you're really calculating questions of justice. If you are in a cartel industry that has been cartelized since 1913 and, you know, basically said that you got to accept federal funds, even if you don't want them, such as BB&T, for example, refused bailout money, but then was forced to take it because if they did refuse to take the if they didn't receive the money, then that would signal the weakness in the rest of the market. That's a really thing that as a literal thing that happened. Right. But all you got to know is bankers equal bad. And therefore, you know, like it's collectivism error. And then additionally that. You know, so the if you're in this, you know, government controlled monopoly cartel that is the banking system, you are in a situation where even in the worst case scenario, you don't get to deny loans without getting accused of being racist. You're gonna start accepting loans, right? That you otherwise might not based upon the financials. And perhaps there were racists there. I think there was studies on how racist the banking sector was that based a lot of the community banking reforms, supposed reforms, that was one of the drivers, not the sole driver, of the financial crisis and some of the problems that we had. But then you're over here and you're saying, well, what about all the people who bought all the mortgage-backed derivatives? Well, those were all ranked by government rating agencies, ones that were captured by the banking sector. But what do you expect? This is another one of those examples of like the progressives create the system and then complain about the system that they created and then use that to justify more of the same thing that they created the system on. You cartelize the banking industry. You get mad when the banking industry fails in a giant boom bust cycle because you're, and then you refuse to even, what's even more frustrating, refuse to even look at the Federal Reserve as an actor in the economy. They pretend like it doesn't exist. And then they do the same thing in healthcare. They create the AMA, they create all the boards of health, they create all the cartelizing of the labor industry in this. They regulate the hell out of everything with all the regulatory agencies, and then they're surprised when it's expensive. So then they subsidize it. And when you subsidize supply of something or demand for something, guess what happens? It goes up in price because you have an expanded supply. And so they're the ones doing this. And this, it's just like, if you just follow the connections, you can get insight, but that is a outside in look. Economics and the praxeological study of human action is what gets you the bottom up inside outlook into these incentives and structures. And if you don't have that, you can really easily get led astray and you start advocating for things that would be incredibly unjust, such as executing the bankers of BB&T who didn't even need these things. BB&T was such a good spot during the financial crisis. They had two sets of books for every transaction. One was the federal set of books that were required by federal accounting standards, and the other one was for their actual real financial standards. So that's and you treat those people as if they're just the same, which right. would be incredibly unjust.
Absolutely.
As opposed to Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers, who are sitting there, you know, asking for the bailout.
Totally. Really quick, for folks that aren't familiar, what is BB&T?
Oh, it's a banking chain in the East Coast.
Gotcha.
All over okay. the place in the East Coast. Yeah, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting the BB&T branch.
It's a weird thing to say, David.
I don't know.
Is that a Montana?
Is it Macomb? Yeah. You don't know that? Swing a dead cat? No?
Nope. Never heard that before.
Well, I'm old school like that. All right. Well, let's get back to it.
All right.
That killed hundreds of thousands of Americans through their basically cocaine-infused pills known as OxyContin, hooked people to the point of overdoses. Did the Sacklers face criminal charges, the death penalty? No, they're rich, so they got off with some fines. How about Flint, Michigan, which 11 years...
Should we kill the Sackler family because they brought OxyContin to America? Should we indict them, maybe, like, or do something more dramatic to them personally?
Well, that depends on who you ask, apparently. I mean, they did lie about the addictiveness of their product.
Mm-hmm.
That did result in a lot of deaths.
Did the FDA not say that it was safe and effective?
Well, of course they did, but I'm fairly certain the FDA official who said it was safe and effective went to work for them afterwards.
Is that true? Well, I wouldn't be surprised. That checks out just by, you don't even have to look it up. I believe you.
I'm going to look it up.
Because that's how these systems work. But that said, like, I totally get it. Like, that's the direction that I think people could totally go with that. But there's an interesting question here that does get to the root, once again, of progressivism as its influence on our society and our culture. So think about this. So there are two ways to regulate an economy, right? There's the common law property rights way that we basically operated on and we inherited from the English going all the way back to the founding of the country to the progressive era into the 1960s and 70s, right? That transform of change between, you know, the 1930s and, you know, kind of FDR era to the 1960s with the creation of the EPA and the FDA and all that kind of stuff, the 1960s and 70s, these things were managed one way before then and one way afterward. The way before then was if you do something that harms someone else, you then have a standard of evidence and an adversarial process in order in liability, tort law, to seek damages. So knowing that, companies would need to be very careful to make sure that they didn't hurt anybody. That doesn't mean companies never hurt anybody. This is reality what we live in, where companies can be like, wow, we could buy off the judges, or we could do something corrupt, or we could do, like, those sorts of things happen. on the other vision, the progressive vision that we transitioned to, that we currently operate under, that the OxyContin was said to be safe and effective and non-addictive, I think, even. It was part of, was one of the things that were found, if I remember right.
That was the primary thing, was that it was less addictive than the alternatives.
Yeah. So where they come in, they say, well, expert opinion and scientific management have told us that these are, that therefore this is good. And one of the challenges here is once you introduce the, we're going to administrate you before you act, then you have this natural kind of political Newtonian physics-like pushback that says, well, then don't make us liable, right? Because you can't have both regulated in the market afterwards and have the government controlling everything you do.
That's fair.
So, and this is oftentimes, this is actually creates the case for removing liability. It's the worst case possible, but it is the case. And I, you know, you can understand where the businesses are coming from because they're saying you tell us that we're safe, and then we release a thing and it's less safe than we thought. Now we're also liable, even as we sought your approval ahead of time to make sure it was safe.
Totally.
Now maybe
true,
they break the game and all that kind of stuff, but I'm still in the case of, they've created this incentive structure in the system to remove liabilities from these companies by advocating for their management up front in the first place. And then all of the things that come from that management up top by these agencies, they're not responsible for, apparently, even as their philosophy to say that. And they have no solution how to handle it otherwise.
Totally fair. And on the other side of it, though, say companies are held liable, like healthcare companies are held liable. It's very commonplace for class action lawsuits to take place where the law firms make tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on the deal. And your average consumer who may have been, you know, maimed or worse by a given therapeutic, whatever the treatment is, gets like $16. Yeah. So I can see where your average American would say that system isn't broken. That's not working for me. That's not making me whole. Mm-hmm. And I can't afford to go to court against Purdue Pharma or whomever. So how do you reconcile that?
So I think that's actually a set of quite easy political steps. Number one, you take the FDA, you close it down. You then take all that money, the gazillions of dollars we spent on the FDA, and then you move it into more courts. So you increase the supply of legal services, making legal services cheaper. You then, all you have to do is then you have to just change the minimums on the things that you can take tort liability suits for. So at that point, then you can seek major damages from a large corporation, and they now have to be very careful about the sort of things that they release to the public. And then, of course, on top of that, and this goes back to the deeper legal theory, is you have to change some of the things about the legal theory. So part of the legal theory that we currently operate under, made in the very late liberal era or very early progressive era, was this whole calculation of public benefit where they say, well, if there's enough public benefit for a thing being happening, therefore it's okay for it to happen, right? The short of that is that. So a train goes by your farm, it shoots suet everywhere, it kills a bunch of crops. Well, we need industrialization so that we can have a modern prosperous economy. Therefore, there's no injury here that you can sue for. We got to roll that crap back and say, no, actually property rights really matters. Actually individual welfare really matters. And, you know, but in the danger, and then additionally that, you got to figure out how to do this with contract, right? Because at the end of the day, if someone sells you a thing and says, here's what the effects are, here's what the things that could happen with it are, and they are liable for it, but you and the contract say, I'm not going to hold you liable for this because I need the pain medication, that would neutralize a lot of the liability question. The question is then, it's like, what do you do when it gets out of hand from that? How do you make sure that you're not getting to the place of, if they lie on the contract and say it's not addictive, now you have a very clear contract case that you can now pursue and hold them accountable for.
Very fair. Boy, wouldn't that be nice if we lived in that world?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying it's perfect either. I'm saying there'll be companies who try to skirt the system. There'll be companies that threaten people and do all kinds of terrible stuff. But noting that happens now too. We just don't see it as much. You know, and I appreciate it, like this guy, like covering, you know, terrible abuses from big pharma or terrible abuses from insurance companies. That's all great. I think those things are good. It's just, what is your solution? And your solution is more of the same things, but with more controls in the way that you would wish they could be done, as opposed to empowering the individual to seek redress of grievances for a particular injury in particular evidentiary standards. So then, you know, it actually is a real injury and it's not just going after BB&T for the same thing that Lehman Brothers did or something like that.
Right.
All right. Let's totally. See what else I can say. I like this guy. I'm having a lot of fun with this.
11 years later, is still in crisis, still has toxic water, despite the bullshit you've heard from the mainstream media. I've been there and I've reported 21 times in Flint, including my book last year, We the Poisoned, exposing the Flint water cover-up and the poisoning of 100,000 Americans. Water's still toxic 11 years later. No one has gone to prison and no one will go to prison because the Attorney General of Michigan, a Democrat, sabotaged the criminal investigation. So the government officials and private actors who poison poor people, majority black, no one will see a day in prison, much less face a death penalty.
I'm in total agreement. Yeah, this is an easy one. Heck yeah! I'm not sure we should be killing people for the water problem in Flint, Michigan. I don't. I'm not a fan of the death penalty, but God damn, that's a terrible story. You know, like it really I totally feel for that. Like that is just awful. What's going on in Flint. And it's shocking to me that we could have this much public understanding and no solution can come to the fore for a government that's obviously an entrenched interest.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Why hasn't a solution come forward?
I will confess, I don't know enough about Flint, Michigan to be able to say what's going on there. I just don't. I mean, I'm aware of the story. I've heard about it, but I haven't like dug the deep dive. I don't know what their arrangement is. I don't know enough to actually be able to tell you. But it's an interesting question of like, why can't any accountability happen? For God's sakes, like why can't there's a million questions. Once you get to government, it becomes really clear. Like there's a million questions I have about why things never change with government. And that's part of the problem of relying on government to provide you goods and services. You know, it has certain advantages of scalability and being able to keep free riders from happening and things like that. But it has significant trade-offs, such as it is the tool of coercion in our society. That's what it does. It doesn't do anything else that well, but it will do that really well. So holding the thing that has all the weapons and guns and ability to legitimately use force accountable is really hard. Holding a big corporation way easier, right? Because there's one thing bigger than the big corporation. That's the justice system. In the ideal sense, right? I mean, and you could say, oh man, that's just so idealistic. The justice system would work on behalf. Well, everyone's asking for that. He's asking for that. Who isn't asking for a just justice system?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all want that, truly. Maybe there are different pictures of what just is. I know there are, but how do you keep the justice system from being corrupted?
Well, strong founding laws, right? So having a constitution and something a broad based understanding of what those rights mean. Now, I can't tell you that we currently have that, right? Like after last week. And everything going on with the student visas and people's thoughts about the First Amendment not applying because, you know, they just want it to apply only to citizens. I can't say that the Constitution's understanding is very strong, but that's a relatively small sample set and maybe heavily biased for internet commentary. You know, so at least a part of that is anti-corruption policy. There is a lot of literature. There's a surprising amount of literature, especially in international development, about how to prevent corruption. It has a lot to do with, you know, paying people enough that are in those roles, selection process for roles like police officers to agents of the government. But there's rich literature on exactly how to approach those things. Not saying there's any like magic pill there, just saying that there's a lot there that you could dive into to make clear. OK, how do you make sure that your justice system does approach justice? Some of that is like qualified immunity and other kinds of government immunities that they apply to themselves. That would be eliminating as many of those as possible, because if you can, as a government official, violate the law, then what, do we have justice in any meaningful sense? And if you can't be held accountable with a lawsuit, do we have justice in any meaningful sense? And especially given the propensity for, you know, both the executive branch and judicial branch to collude in order to prevent accountability. That's happened many times in American history. That should not be unweighed. But what you want to do is have firm reasons for them not to collude. And those are achievable, but not always easy.
Totally. Yeah. Do you want to keep playing this clip or are you ready to hit our next topic?
We should move on. We're halfway through. Let's move about here. Because I do want to talk about the congressional hearing on the JFK assassination. So we have the special committee on government secrets and disclosure Congresswoman Luna kicked it off, I thought, with a really interesting question to Jefferson Morley, who's a former Washington Post reporter and editor at JFK Facts Substack, which I subscribe to and I do recommend people check out. I really dug it. Let's see if I can get this correct.
I now recognize myself for some questions. Mr. Morley, why do you say that the Oswald file was sitting on the desk of James Angleton a week before the assassination? Can you really prove that?
Yes, I can. In the Oswald file, on page 254 and on page 275, you'll see a routing slip on two FBI reports about Oswald. And on November 15th, 1963, and November 14th, 1963, you'll see the initials J-A-R on the routing slip. That stands for Jane Atherton Roman. She was the liaison officer for Mr. Angleton. So when she signed for those two FBI reports, we have proof positive that they were on Mr. Angleton's desk.
Now, the reason why that's important is that James Angleton, just to remind everybody, because we talked about him before, but just a real quick reminder, is that he was the head of counterintelligence for the CIA. Counterintelligence is knowing where the opposition spies are and working to counter those spies within your own country and overseas. Now, keep in mind, this is before the Church Commission came in and said the CIA can't operate in the United States. Now, that was the popular understanding of what the CIA would be doing prior to the Church Committee, which was in the mid to late 70s. This is the 1960s, right? So a very different era in our understanding of the CIA. Now, with that, the question is, I think the consensus alternative theory is that the CIA had cultivated a relationship with Oswald directly as a counterintelligence agent, that his job was to infiltrate the center left, the Marxist groups, the friendly Castro groups, and then, you know, basically be able to work within them in a counterintelligence capacity. But we don't have that document that was on his desk. We just know that there was a document on his desk. At least we don't have the full document. Let's keep going into it. I'll show you anymore.
Are you saying that the three men, Angleton, Helms, and Joannides, plotted to kill the president?
No, I am not saying that. I'm saying that they were engaged in covert activities related to Lee Harvey Oswald that have never been disclosed. And that's the imperative for the task force, to obtain those records of that secret operation.
Now, that's the right answer to that, right? Because we don't know. But the important thing to understand is that there was an important relationship that he had with intelligence. When he was arrested in New Orleans, for example, Oswald requested to meet with the FBI. Right? Now, why not the CIA if he was a CIA asset? Because you would never request to meet with the CIA as a domestic person in America, right? That would be the opposite of what it would mean to be a spy. Right, it would be to request, hey, can I talk to my spy agency? I've been arrested. Right, what you would do is you go to the federal police, they would talk to the CIA, they would get you out. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That also makes sense from the mainstream narrative in this way. The way they interpret it within the Warren Report is that they were monitoring him for the purpose of a counterintelligence because they believed he was a USSR asset. Does that make sense? So the defenders of the Warren Report in the mainstream interpretation of the lone gunman theory and all that kind of stuff would say that therefore this was just them being worried about that he was a USSR agent. But that doesn't explain much of the total phenomena. Like, for example, he gets back into the United States after living in the USSR and brings his Russian wife with him and faces no real problems. Goes to Mexico City, comes back, crosses the border twice, supposedly. There's some question there, but supposedly, and gets no real hassle, right? Right up into the day where they're sending the president to Dallas and they know he's in Dallas, and that document that says where he is, every place that he's lived probably, is on the desk of the counterintelligence chief at the time when he goes to Dallas. Well, when JFK does.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Real quick, I'd like to enter into the record a document that was actually one of these declassified documents of the CIA rejecting the lone gunman theory. Without objection, so ordered. Mr. Morley, who was George Joannides, and why do you emphasize the importance of getting this file?
George Ioannidis was a career CIA officer. In 1963, he was chief of the covert action branch of the Miami station. His agents had contact with Oswald before the assassination. His agents in the top secret program, AMSPEL, generated propaganda about Oswald's pro-Castro activities both before and after the assassination. When Mr. Ioannidis was questioned by congressional investigators here on Capitol Hill in 1978, he was asked who was running these Cuban students who had all this contact with Oswald. The investigators had no idea that they were looking at the answer to their question. And Mr. Ioannidis, who had been running that Cuban student group, told congressional investigators, "I don't know. I'll get back to you." That was obstruction of Congress. That was an obstruction of an investigation of the president's assassination. His records have never been fully released by the Central Intelligence Agency, and they obviously should be.
Yeah, so really interesting there. So important reminder. So the current mainstream consensus alternative theory is that there is at least a component to the motive and the material evidence for a not a lone gunman, Oswald shooting Malone, was the motive being a blowback from the Bay of Pigs and not supporting the Cuban exiles in the Bay of Pigs. And two, the people around that we were training at the time to fight in war and to be basically harassing terrorist-like activities across the Caribbean against the Cuban regime were people like this, and specifically concentrated around Miami. Now, remembering Operation Northwoods was specifically targeted in Miami. This guy would have been the guy to pull off Operation Northwoods had Operation Northwoods been approved, but it was not. So these guys were talking about with Oswald beforehand, putting out propaganda about Oswald beforehand and afterwards about his pro-Castro stuff. Now, the question is, was Oswald's activities, pro-Castro activities, specifically in New Orleans, but I assume Miami maybe has like jurisdiction over New Orleans, because where Oswald got in trouble with his New Orleans for passing out pro-Castro literature. The question is whether or not that was done on their behest, or were they monitoring and then putting out that stuff beforehand? And it's just really strange that you would promote somebody if you're the guy who's there to actually fight the communists. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. 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 For sure. Huh. This is crazy. This is crazy. So where does this take the conversation around the JFK assassination? What are people taking away from this?
Well, so the larger part of this is that there was clear knowledge that the FBI and the CIA were tracking Oswald before it all went down, right? And what does that mean? And we still don't have enough to know that, right? And once again, what I don't suspect is in this file is going to be, well, we have this great asset. His name is Lee Harvey Oswald, and he's going to assassinate the president, or on the opposite side of that, what might be true, but I would imagine they would have destroyed this if it was in there, would be something along the lines of, we have this asset that's helping us with the, you know, infiltrating of the left communists, and we're going to, use that asset to try to get to the USSR, right? In fact, he did. Well, I mean, first he left the USSR, probably on behalf of intelligence, but we don't know. Came back, and then he was applying to try to get into Cuba and then was rejected. That's why he was in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if he was just in that place where his job was to try to infiltrate those, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, the place where he was at as Marine before, when he served in the U.S. military, was in a base in Japan that we were using for our overflights of Russia, and was highly secretive. And in fact, we already knew before all these new files came out that he had offered to give these secrets all the way to the USSR. We know that because counterintelligence knew that, and yet they still didn't harass the guy, be on top of the guy enough to stop the assassination, if indeed the lone gunman theory is true. So what's going on there? Is it just, cover your in your ass, or is it a planned operation where you have somebody who is an asset, you know where he is, you know he has the background where you can claim that he was an agent of the USSR, and if you're trying to start a war with the USSR or Cuba, you know, it's really helpful that he was once in the USSR and he passed out pro literature, Castro literature, New Orleans, all that kind of stuff. So you could see the setup for him being a patsy in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I don't want to sound like Ben Shapiro here, or maybe I do. Hey. this whole conversation around the relevance, you know, the importance of the JFK assassination conversation, what is your hope about what this brings to the conversation more broadly in the United States right now? Like, do you think there's something that's meaningful that will come from this? If, say, we do find out for a fact the CIA was behind JFK's assassination, what's going to happen after that?
Yeah, my biggest hope is that we will get a dialogue about the nature of executive power, specifically in relationship to the creation of the CIA, and the complete, I mean, number one, unconstitutional, but number two, just completely bonkers status that they have to be able to literally do anything they want to do as long as the president orders it. And that wasn't in the law. Now, remember, the creation of the CIA under Eisenhower happens under Truman or Eisenhower? Eisenhower happens as they pass the bill that becomes the CIA. They say, we need an intelligence service so that it can be the newspaper of the president to gather all the best information so the president can make informed decisions. And then he passes a national security directive to say, yeah, you're going to do that, but you're also going to just be able to do whatever I want you to do. And that became covert ops. And that is insane, because that's not the way a republic works. A republic works that if we want to do an action to affect a foreign adversary, we debate it in public, and then we declare it with Congress, and then the executive goes off and does that. That is the structure of government you're taught in middle school and in high school. We don't live under that. What we live under is that Congress is largely a political body that exists to fight and or support the president's decisions it makes without Congress. And because we have this, and then since then, it's got even worse, such as, you know, let me give you an example. Joseph. I don't know why I keep calling you Joseph. Joe, what is the legal basis for Trump's bombing of Yemen? Do we know?
I have no idea.
I don't know either. It came to me today. I was just thinking about it. Like, wait a minute. We covered that story, and I never even looked it up. Now, it could be the 2001 AUMF. But that would indicate that for somehow the Houthis are connected to Al-Qaeda. So I don't know. Maybe they are, but who knows?
I mean, that whole family tree is so confusing to me. I couldn't even begin to tell you.
Yeah, I don't think there's a good case there, but maybe there is. Number two, 2002 AUMF would have to do with Iraq. So they obviously have nothing to do with 2002 AUMF. So maybe it's the 2001 AUMF. Maybe it is just the War Powers Act from the 1970s. It says that the president can pretty much go to war for 90 days whenever he wants to. And then he has to seek congressional authorization.
It's like time off, you know, like you can take this many days before you gotta start paying for it.
No joke. It is that crazy. I mean, and basically, like, the mental model, step back for just a second there and just look at the big picture, is we lost the plot. We're not a constitutional republic anymore, because now the president's absorbed all these war powers he'd never had. And we just didn't change the constitution to give him those war powers. We just created a legal doctrine that said that the legislature can delegate to the executive a bunch of powers that the Constitution gives it. But that's not our traditional understanding of how the Constitution's structured or what the structure of government we live under is. So therefore, you know, we live in an extra constitutional age. And then you're sitting there saying, like, well, what does that mean? And then you're like, well, okay, at a minimum, we should be looking at these institutions such as the CIA, but we should be saying, well, is this actually serving the purpose that we need it to? And then, you know, structural reform after that. And hopefully what this does is it raises the negatives of those institutions so that people, there's actually political will to do something about it.
Absolutely. Obviously that would have to be a grassroots effort. The people would have to demand that of the representatives, because currently, as we know, especially in the Senate, there's no appetite to challenge the intelligence state at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's really the challenge, but that's also the building block of everything. Everything is bottom up, inside out, right? So outside in when it comes to politics. So the bottom up of that is that everyday people, they get educated, they understand what's going on. I mean, think about it for a moment for the Iraq war. When I was coming up as a young person, the Iraq war was obvious, like, well, that's what we have to do in order to stop Saddam Hussein from destroying the world or getting weapons of mass destruction, whatever. And then by 2016, that was a complete idiocy. And how could you possibly do that, Bush family, where Donald Trump could become the locus of that? Now, if this entire time we had known that the CIA had actually played a role in the assassination of JFK, we would have a very different relationship with the intelligence agencies, right? And it's surprising, like, for example, what hasn't evolved on this. So like the intelligence agency obviously going after a sitting president and Trump has moved the right wing into being skeptics of this in this moment, but they're not going to stay there. Right. Because their first allegiance is to the tribe and second to principle. And that's just the nature of most people in politics. The left, who JFK was a Democrat and like the darling of the left, they spent this committee hearing trying to make it about Donald Trump and how bad he is. I'm not kidding. Like, and in the most securitist, like, ridiculous way possible. And it just goes to show you, like, this is a game to these people. They don't really care about the structure of our government or our constitution. They are just doing this for the fundraising dollars, to keep the power, to be famous people, and to do all that stuff for some people, not everybody, but at least the people who did that, because it's a shameful act. Like, how could you have this expert on the JFK assassination right in front of you? And then you say, like, well, what do you think about Signalgate? After all, JFK was really interested in secure communications or some idiocy like that. I mean,
laughable.
It was killer.
But again, not to be unexpected, in my view, unfortunately. Yeah.
So we also had Oliver Stone there, and he was the famous guy who made the JFK movie and, you know, has been a figure in popularizing the alternative consensus theory on JFK. And he had an interesting question go to him. We'll play that real quick.
James Angleton, before he died, who was one of the original members of the CIA, was talking about Dulles and Helms and the others, what he called the Grand Masters. And he's a Catholic. Angleton was a Catholic in search, perhaps, of repentance before his death. He did say, quote, if you were in a room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. I guess I will see them soon. This is our democracy. This is our presidency. It belongs to us. Treat us with respect. Thank you. Mm.
Well said. Well said. Yeah. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, so that whole deathbed confession bit from him, it's a longer quote. He just took a selection of it. It is very revealing, right? What it suggests is that there was a lot to confess and that they did a lot of lying to the American public, and there was a lot of reconciliation that Angleton wanted to have with the very real, you know, evil that the CIA conducted this time. And I mean that. I mean, experimenting on people, like, they're kind of the things that we talked about when we talked about MK Ultra and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, you know, one of the things that notes for me for this is, like, it isn't about that there is a smoking gun anywhere here. It isn't about any particular one single evidence. It's really when you get into the alternative consensus theory, it's about the preponderance. It's about the overall. It's about the forest, not the trees. When you start looking at the forest, you start looking at how many people died who had something to say against the narrative, who had some piece of evidence that, you know, was inconvenient, that was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and then maybe saw something and then spoke up, who ended up either, you know, basically saying, I will never speak again because I'm worried for my life, or, you know, did that. And when you look at the totality of that, and when you look at things like the autopsy report and the logistics of the single bullet theory, when you look at the alternative witnesses that never really got vetted by the Warren Commission, both because of time, some of it being because of time. And second to that, we now know that LBJ specifically said that this needed to be about Oswald, about why Oswald did it. Not trying to find an alternative, but why Oswald did it. noting that this happened months, not years, that the Warren report actually comes out after the act. So Oswald's already dead. And when you look at all of that, and oh, lastly, when you look at the evidence of this change in JFK's motives when it came to his relationship with Khrushchev and to Castro, when you look at, specifically look this up to, I can't recommend enough, the American University speech, and you notice the difference in direction and the separation between him and the members of the national security establishment, that's when the picture starts to come together and you could be like, okay, I'm open to this. Because for a long time, I wasn't. I was like, this is a boomer theory, conspiracy theory. I don't, this is since too long ago. I had Ben Shapiro's point of view. Like, I don't see why it matters. It's like forever ago. And like, you know, who cares? It's satisfactory to me that that's what I was taught. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. But the, but when you really, if you take it seriously, you look at the preponderance, it's very persuasive at the end of the day. And I hope people will. I mean, I feel a little bit like it's impossible to cover well at the end of the day, because there's just so much to go through and so much background to cover and connections to make. That's hard to pull it all together. One, you know, 30-minute piece. But I can't recommend people look at specifically JFK and the Unspeakable. Is an excellent book to really dive into a lot of this. I really felt that. I read another one. I didn't like it as much. JFK the Unspeakable was the better. So
awesome. Yeah. Well, we will put links to both of those, the American University speech and the book you just mentioned, in the show notes and the description below the video, so people can check those out if they'd like to.
100%.
I think that's great. And I, you know, certainly think this topic deserves more attention, deserves people's time. Because of what you said, the ramifications of this are that we will eventually come to a point, hopefully as a public, where we have the right amount of skepticism of the intelligence state. And maybe someday that'll be enough to change our relationship with it, or its relationship with us.
Yes. I mean, just imagine if we had the appropriate amount of skepticism in 2001, when they said, well, we got pictures of aluminum tubes, so therefore Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Maybe we wouldn't have gone to Iraq. Maybe a million people wouldn't be dead right now. Maybe would trillions of dollars of money wouldn't have been wasted. Maybe thousands of American servicemen injured or dead or irreparably harmed psychologically forever now from that. Right. You know, just imagine if we had an appropriate amount of skepticism for the deep state, for the intelligence state, and for the American national security establishment. We had appropriate levels of understanding the phenomena there. Tremendous evil wouldn't have happened in the first place. So anything that drives that point forward that says, oh, wait a minute, here's what they did in the 1960s. And it's really interesting and sexy because it's like, oh, they're playing with LSD and they're doing assassination stuff. And it's like interesting. That's a good thing, to the degree that it actually sparks moral outrage and that, like, wow, isn't that so neat? I wish we could do, like the spy novelization of it, the fetishization of the spy as like, oh, well, they're all just, it's like James Bond out there doing the right thing for keeping the world safe. And don't get me wrong, there's probably some of that is true. But there is the net aggregate is, I think, irrefutable. You look at Nicaragua and you have your answer right there. 36 years of civil war, hundreds of thousands of people dead. I mean, just terrifying things done with this apparatus that we're talking about right now. And this, you know, we look at it as if, oh, they killed JFK. That's terrible. But the well is so much deeper than that. It goes way further than that, and it'll make you lose your hair. I mean, looking at that.
Obviously, I haven't looked deep enough, and maybe I never will. I like my hair.
Yeah, exactly. Don't do it. Don't do it, kids. You don't want this drug.
It's a hell of a drug, ain't it? Any final thoughts, David, before we wrap up?
No, sir. Thank you so much for watching, guys. Don't forget to like, subscribe. Subscribe to our Discord. We got a lot of great conversation going on in there. Some spicy memes that I posted today. Vadoff Vimler was a good one. I really enjoyed that one. but yeah, check it out. We got some great stuff going on in the Discord. Become a member. Join the Secure Containment Information Facility where you can get our spiciest takes. And yeah, thank you for watching.
There may be even spicier takes now that we'll have members of the Daily Wire community joining us in the Discord, because we're now a Daily Wire show, right?
Could you imagine how hated we would be by the average Daily Wire viewer? At this point, maybe 5 years ago, we would be totally reasonable. They'd love us. But right now, oh my God.
We're radicalized. We're way too far gone. Everybody, thank you for watching. We will see you in the next one. We'll
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.